This week's episode of War Rocket Ajax is brought to you by Loot Crate. Go to lootcrate.com/warrocketajax and use the offer code warrocketajax to get $3 off a brand new subscription.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That's War Rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts on this lovely, rainy, early summer evening slash afternoon, depending on when you're listening to this. Matt, is it raining up there? Because we had just a hellacious thunderstorm a second ago.
Are we going to get the Ajax weather report out of here early on?
Yeah, well, it's a new feature I'm trying out, because okay. I'm old, and you're old.
I'm about to be older. We'll get to that in a second. Yeah, we had a little thunderstorm earlier today, but it has died off, so now it's just muggy.
My name is Chris Sims. With me, as always, is Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, are you doing okay in the mugginess?
I'm living. I'm staying indoors in the air conditioning, and I feel all right. Chris, I hope you're staying dry and safe.
Oh. Matt, I like this new thing you're doing with your adjectives.
Where I stretch them out.
That's a good, signature. Like, when you meet a new person, they'll be like, Matt? Oh yeah, Matt with the adjectives.
Yeah, it feels like a radio thing. It feels like something a morning radio person would do. Right?
That's where we're trying to get everybody. I don't know if you know, the bubble's about to burst. I can feel it.
That's right.
But if we could get into terrestrial radio, that's where the action's at these days.
You know what? Terrestrial radio is the future. Podcasts are today. And we have a great episode for everybody this week of War Rocket Ajax. We're back with another panel president special because we have a lot of panel president lists to get through.
So many.
So we're going to do that in just a little while. But Chris, before we get to that, we've got business to take care of, starting with our newest Patreon supporters.
Oh, that's right, Matt. These are the people who have gone over to patreon.com/warrocketajax, and they're chipping in a few bucks every month to make sure that we can keep the lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills.
And here are the newest supporters who have done that and helped us out. Joe Quigley.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
Lokio.
Thank you, Lokio.
Daniel Andreev.
Thank you, Daniel.
Michael Becker.
Ah, thank you, Michael.
And Michael J. Williams.
Oh, thank you, Michael J. Williams. That's almost your initials.
Nearly. He put that J in there so he's not confused with the legendary basketball player Michael Williams.
I thought you were going to say the colorist.
I made it a Michael B. Jordan joke instead. Those are our newest supporters on Patreon. If you would like to do what they did and help us out and get some cool stuff in the process, including ad-free episodes of the show, special bonus audio content, and more, you can go to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kick in a few bucks. All right, Chris, let's do some checks and recs.
Let's do it.
Chris, what are you checking in with this week?
Well, Matt, I want to tell everybody that we're going to be at Heroes Con in 2 weeks, starting on June 17th. That's pretty exciting.
That's right. Next week, we'll have a regular Ajax, and then the week after that, we'll be doing our annual special from the Heroes Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. In fact, the table assignments just went out today.
Where are you?
My table is 1125.
Well, that's not too far. I'm at 1017. I'm actually really, really stoked about my table position because I am right next to Erica Henderson. She is right next to Joe Quinones. And then right around the corner is Jordan Gibson and Lauren Moran. So I'm pretty excited to to be seeing all of those folks.
Yeah, that's a good
group. Every waking minute of 3 days.
That's a good group to be next to. I'm actually one table down from our friend Benita Serino.
Nice.
Along with Kevin Warren, the artist of Copernicus Jones Robot Detective. So I think we're only like one section away from each other, so we should be in pretty close proximity. It's going to be really fun. If you're going to be at HeroesCon, be sure to come by and say hi to both of us.
Yeah, that's not my main check, though. My main check, it's a continuation of last week, because it's time to talk about mystery boxes.
Oh, yeah. Hit me up with this mystery box info.
First of all, I want to say a huge thank you to all the people who have so far jumped on the mystery box train. The first few people who got them should be getting theirs, if not today, then soon. So I hope they like them. I try to make sure every box has at least one good comic in it. You know, value pack style. But I am now doing the next step in this. I'm still doing mystery boxes. I'm still going to be doing mystery boxes. Obviously, HeroesCon is going to, you know, throw a wrench into some of those plans. But as far as drumming up the money for my move, I've moved into the phase where I'm separating out stuff that I think deserves a little bit of non-mystery box flogging, I guess. So if you're interested in checking out what I have to offer, I'm going to put a link on Tumblr, I think, but you can go to the-isb.com/yardsale2016.txt, because I am doing it old school with a text file, and it's I've got some stuff in there that I think people might want. It turns out I have two copies of Mad Love. I'm probably the only person surprised by that, but yeah, I have two copies of the first printing of Mad Love. I would rather have a new sofa. See, I've got like a run of the first 60 issues of Invincible is going to be in there. Those are kind of the highest ones. I've got the first year of Batman Adventures that includes Harley Quinn's first appearance in comics. So if any of that is stuff that you are interested in checking out, obviously I've also got a ton of hardcovers and paperbacks that I'm going to be adding to the list over the next couple weeks, just to get on with the move. Please check those out. Shoot me an email if you're interested, just like the mystery boxes. And if you feel like rolling the dice, then the mystery boxes will continue until I am done with these three long boxes that are sitting in the office right now. So I've got quite a few to get through. Quite a few issues of Brave and the Bold with Nemesis backups to get through, Matt, I think. What is your check this week? I bet I know what it is.
My check this week is that 2 days from the day that this episode is going up will be my birthday.
Hey, birthday! Hey, you know what we can do now? You know what we can do?
What can we do?
Happy birthday to you. It's
right.
Public domain now.
That's right.
Happy birthday to you. Go to hell, Mildred and Patty Hill.
You miserly old sisters.
Oh, you made me laugh too hard. I lost it. I gotta start over. Happy birthday. The sheer amount of joy that Paul F. Tompkins takes in his podcast of singing it in its entirety whenever he can, now that it is in the public domain at last.
Rub it in the faces of Mildred and Patty Hill.
Yeah, you know what? I gotta say, I regret being rude to them already, but also that song is a standard.
Yep, it's my birthday in 2 days, and I already tweeted out my wish list. I'm going to, I guess, because I'm shameless, put it in the show notes for this episode. My birthday's on a Wednesday this year, which is kind of a plus and a minus. There's pros and cons, because on the one hand, it's in the middle of the week. The actual day, you know, is in the middle of the week. But then also, you can really assign it to two weekends free and clear, right? Like there's no way you could say that the weekends on either side of it, like one is better than the other because they're equidistant. So that's the one benefit of a Wednesday birthday. That said, I don't really know what all my plans are. I would like to go bowling at some point. Bowling on or around my birthday is a tradition that I think I would like to keep going. It's going to be my birthday soon. Chris, we'll have that brief period where our ages are the same number, which is always a fun time.
It's so fun every year.
and then things will change come August, but that will not be until August.
Now here's my question for you, Matt. Do you want me to do what I normally do, which is bring you your present at HeroesCon?
That sounds like the easiest thing.
Okay.
I think that makes the most sense. And HeroesCon is closer to my birthday this year than it has been in some years. There was that one year when it fell actually on my birthday, which is unusual. But sure, just bring it to HeroesCon. I think that will be A-okay.
Well, Matt, here is my other question. Are there like any 10 specific comics that you want from these long boxes for your birthday present?
I suspected that it might be a mystery box. That's fully what I'm expecting it to be.
I gotta say, mystery box purchasers are literally buying your birthday present this year. So if you like War Rocket Ajax, it's kind of a thing for both of us.
All right, Chris, let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend this week?
Oh, Matt, I'm about to make your summer so much better.
Oh, I'm ready.
Okay. Matt, what do you know about shrubs?
As in, like, the little bushes outside of a home?
No. As in the refreshing, crisp summer beverage made with vinegar.
I have no familiarity with this summer beverage.
Okay, I also had no familiarity with shrubs, but they're on the menu at Husk in Charleston, the restaurant that I have spoken of very, very highly before. If you're ever in Charleston, get some reservations, go to Husk. You will not regret it, I promise you. A shrub is a drink that was popular in, I guess, in colonial times? Maybe piratey times? It's one of those things where you don't really want to drink water. You know, one of those eras. But they are fantastic, and they have kind of become the Sim Sullivan household signature cocktail. Although it is not, it is optionally alcoholic. So here's what you're going to do. Don't be scared by the vinegar part. Trust me, I'll get to it. What you're going to do is you're going to get 2 cups of strawberries. Okay, you're going to put them in a bowl. You're going to take 2 cups of sugar, put it on top of the strawberries. Just take 2 cups of sugar, pour it on top. Stir it up a little bit. Make sure you get a good mix with the strawberries and the sugar. And then you cover that in like saran wrap in a bowl and you leave it on the counter for 3 days. What's going to happen is the sugar is going to break down the strawberries and it's going to create a strawberry syrup. So then after 3 days, you take the syrup, you strain it into a squeeze bottle, into a mason jar, what have you. That's your syrup. So then you take a little bit of the syrup, like, you know, a couple tablespoons of the syrup. You put it in a glass. Like, as much syrup as you put in, you're going to probably want to do about equal parts of red wine vinegar. You then splash some balsamic vinegar on it. You pour in some seltzer. You put in some ice. And then you stir it and you drink it, and goddamn, it is delicious. It's the best. The vinegar brings out the sweetness, and it's so crisp. It's so good.
Now, how would you say it compares to – because the drink that I got introduced to last year by a friend of mine, Ben Fowler, was a cheerwine cocktail that uses cheerwine, which if you're not familiar with cheerwine – is a cherry soda, native to the Carolinas, and lime juice, and then you can put a little slice of lime on the rim of the cup. And gin, obviously, is in there as well. Now, that I found to be a refreshing summery drink. Mm-hmm. Chris, how do you think a shrub compares to that cheerwine cocktail?
Listen, I'm not going to tell you not to drink a cheerwine cocktail. All right. If that's your thing. I'm just going to tell you that drinking a drink made with vinegar and syrup that you have made on your counter is pretty great. And it's super refreshing.
I feel that there is certainly a sense of accomplishment that comes with that drink.
It's a sense of accomplishment, but it's also a super easy thing because you literally just leave it on the counter for 3 days. Now, I prefer the strawberries. You can do it with, I think, with almost any kind of fruit. We just recently made some peach syrup and had some peach shrubs, which instead of the red wine vinegar with that, we used apple cider vinegar to get kind of a different flavor profile. And again, so delicious, so refreshing. And it's you're going to like it. If you like sweet drinks, if you like that cheer wine cocktail, you're going to like it. I'm thinking about bringing some up to Charlotte and that being my drink of the con. Again, it's non-alcoholic. It's a mocktail. So it goes down really smooth, but it does pair pretty well with gin if you want to splash some gin in there, if you're a gin drinker, if you're a drinker. So yeah, Matt, I think you would enjoy it. I look forward to making one for you.
I'm looking forward to that as well. I think that will be a good venue for me to try it.
Mystery boxes and vinegar drinks. That's what this podcast is about now. As far as I'm concerned. Matt, what is your recommendation this week? What's your rec?
My recommendation is something that has been around for 3 weeks now, but I only became aware of it this week when a writer that you and I both enjoy a lot, David Shoemaker, a guy who writes about wrestling, formerly wrote under the name The Masked Man, he tweeted about his new podcast, which is as yet unnamed. It is so far just called the Ringer Wrestling Podcast. There are 3 episodes of it already. They are all under, however, the kind of generic Ringer podcast channel at the moment, which is called Channel 33. Now, if you're not familiar with The Ringer, let me start there. The Ringer is the new sports and culture website venture that Bill Simmons is doing now that Grantland is closed.
So this is Grantland rising from the ashes.
It's exactly right. So Grantland is gone and Bill Simmons has started The Ringer. David Shoemaker, in addition to being the art director for the website, is also The Ringer's new wrestling writer, like he was the wrestling writer for Grantland. Cheap Heat, the podcast that David Shoemaker hosted with Peter Rosenberg and then later Stat Guy Greg, Cheap Heat has split in twain because it's an ESPN thing that was associated with Grantland. Peter Rosenberg is still doing Cheap Heat, but David Shoemaker left to go do this Ringer stuff and had been gone for several months while Rosenberg and Stat Guy Greg were still doing Cheap Heat. I kind of gave up on Cheap Heat, I'm afraid to say, because Shoemaker was a big part of why I was listening to that show. So I was really excited to hear what David Shoemaker's new podcast was going to be. It has now started at Grantland, but it doesn't have its own feed yet. You just have to go – or I'm sorry, The Ringer. But it doesn't have its own feed yet, so you have to go to just the general feed. And it's like episodes 115, 117, and 120. On each episode so far, he's had on someone to be a guest co-host. On the most recent episode, he had LaToya Ferguson from the AV Club. They talked about the latest episode of Raw, which was really interesting. Weirdly enough, the comments on the SoundCloud version of that episode were all about how David Shoemaker and LaToya Ferguson weren't patriotic enough. Because they talked about John Cena's Memorial Day speech and how sort of cloying it was, and people did not take that well. But aside from that, it is a very enjoyable show. It has a lot of what I liked from Cheap Heat brought over to this show, the kind of analysis of Raw and talking about some stuff from the past. For instance, on the episode with LaToya Ferguson, she and Shoemaker talk about the brand split that's coming up and the possibility of there being a draft for Raw and SmackDown. And so they went back and watched the 2002 episode of Raw that introduced the idea of the previous brand split and talked about what happened on that episode and how it might compare to what they're going to do in July when they do the new brand split, however that's going to work. Also on that episode, he interviews Goldberg, and it is the most beautifully awkward interview. Where it's just like, hey, Goldberg, are you going to get back in the ring? And Goldberg's like, I don't know. I'm smaller than I used to be. And that's just kind of what the whole interview is.
Oh, that's a bummer.
I am enjoying it. It's replacing Cheap Heat for me. So I'm sure that those two podcasts will cross over again at some point. But I don't know. I had to go partisan and stick with Shoemaker in the wrestling podcast wars.
Team Shoemaker.
That's right. And
hashtag it.
And that's my recommendation. Chris, now that we've done our recs, let's talk about some of the comics of the week. All right, Chris, we're going full rebirth this week, I believe.
We're rebirthing, I think, is what we're calling it. No, let's not call it that at all.
I do want to say before we get into rebirth, though, I want to quickly talk about Civil War II, number one. The art in that book by Dave Marquez. Fantastic. Beautiful.
Yes.
Gorgeous. So good.
Super great.
Looks so good. All right.
I was lucky enough to see some of that because the damage control story that Chad and I wrote for Choosing Sides actually takes place right after, when Cap says, all right, let's all clean up. Let's all pitch in and help clean up. Our damage control story picks up right after that panel. So I was lucky enough to see some of the art for that a couple months ago. And geez, Dave Marquez is so good. It's beautiful stuff.
He's always been good. This stuff is next level. It's so good.
Yeah, it's incredible because you see that guy's art and it's like, oh yeah, he's great. And then it levels up again somehow.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
All right. There were four Rebirth books this week. We're not going to be talking about the Batman Rebirth issue at length. Not because we didn't like it, not because we didn't enjoy it, just because there's not a lot to say about it. Mikhail Janin, or Janine, however you say his name, draws Bruce Wayne doing one-armed pull-ups on the helicopter platform real nice. He
draws Bruce Wayne just doing Batman shit, which I love. Like, if Rebirth Batman is the era of doesn't-give-a-fuck Batman, I'm really excited.
But that's really all we have to say about that. It was fun and enjoyable. So we're going to talk about the other three Rebirth books of the week. And I think we're going to start with Green Arrow Rebirth, which I don't know if I should have been that surprised about how much I liked it, but I really liked it.
I didn't read this one until late on Wednesday. And by then, I had heard from like four or five people, you included, who were just like, oh yeah, Green Arrow Rebirth is great. And so I had really high expectations going in, and it certainly met them, but I was like, oh, this is really good. And then that's kind of all I thought of it. But as the night went on and as I kind of thought about it and as I read the other Rebirth books, I kept coming back to it and thinking, like, the more I thought about it, the better it was. Like, it's the best Green Arrow comic in a long time, I think is fair to say.
Yeah, this book is written by Benjamin Percy, with art by Otto Schmidt. It's also edited by Andy Khoury, who is somebody we know, former coworker of ours.
former boss and current pal.
But even if I didn't know Andy was editing this book, I would think it was so good. The way I almost would describe it is, even though I think the art is a step up from a lot of the art of comics of the mid-90s, in some ways it feels like it captures that DC mid-90s feel.
And you know I'm a sucker for that feel.
You know
that's what I am here for. But yeah, like Otto Schmidt, and I told this to Andy, this is not someone that I am at all familiar with. He's fantastic. Not stylized to the point of like a Bill Sienkiewicz, but stylized just enough where everything's distinct and everything has a, you know, he has a feel. He's not a house style guy. Which I think really, really works for Green Arrow if you're going to want to do the thing that you have to do with a Green Arrow, number one, which is make him not Batman.
Yeah, and I think that this issue ticks off some boxes that it has to tick off. Because, you know, Rebirth, number one, set up the Oliver Queen, Dinah Lance, Green Arrow, Black Canary relationship coming back. And this issue does that. It has them you know, meet once again and team up once again and sort of rekindle their relationship. It ticks off the box of establishing Green Arrow as this kind of liberal hero, as a rich guy who helps the poor. And he even describes himself as a social justice warrior at one point, which has the potential to make some readers mad, but I enjoyed greatly. There's a great debate between he and Black Canary about how he can help people fight the man if he is the man. There's the potential that all that stuff could come off as rote, could come off as, yeah, here's Green Arrow again. You remember him. This is all stuff that you remember. Here's Black Canary. Here's some stuff about her. It could all seem very kind of like by the numbers, but this issue doesn't do that. It has a really cool story. It throws some curveballs at the reader because the story is all about these homeless people and kids getting taken to an undisclosed place by these
it's the Forgotten from Batman the Animated Series.
Except it's not just kids, it's like adults too.
Right. But you're thinking of the Underdwellers, Matt. The Forgotten was adults.
Oh, that's right. I was thinking about the Underdwellers. There were two Batman episodes about that. Anyway, there's this scene where Green Arrow is chasing this shadowy figure through an alley, and it seems like that's the kidnapper. But then Black Canary takes off the hooded outfit, and it turns out to be Black Canary instead of the kidnapper. And it's like not the biggest fake out, but it's a little something. Like it's not what I was expecting. But this introductory issue is not afraid to tell you a story, which if I have any complaints about the other Rebirth number ones from this week, is that they all feel kind of like prologue. And this issue feels like is a story. It is a self-contained one-issue story.
The thing that gets me about this issue is that story-wise, I think it's a little lacking. It's very basic. Until you find out that like the people auctioning off the homeless are like Draculas. I don't know what they are, but they look like Nosferatus.
They're not regular humans, at the very least.
Yeah. But what it did for me was it got the character stuff so well. Like, I was really worried about Green Arrow and Black Canary in, you know, when we read Rebirth number one, because, like, the whole idea of them being, you know, destined... I keep wanting to say destined moon lovers, because that's what I always say about Sailor Moon and Tuxedo Mask. But the idea that, like, oh, they have to be together. You know, like we have to have this relationship back. This is a core element of the DC universe. Like, I was really worried that this issue was going to, like, pull some of that in and have it be just like, oh, it's destiny. We immediately love each other. You know, like, oh, yeah, I have memories of you from the past. You know, like a low rent version of the nearness of you, you know, because that would be terrible. But what it does is it really it doesn't dismiss anything that's gone on with Black Canary in Batgirl and in the Black Canary solo title. It doesn't immediately have their relationship makes sense, and it feels like a fresh start for two characters in a way that I think is going to certainly make Green Arrow better, and hopefully will also make Black Canary better. Like, I feel like Black Canary works on her own in a way that Green Arrow doesn't when he's not with Black Canary. Like, Green Arrow and Black Canary is a relationship that benefits Green Arrow more than Black Canary, if you know what I mean. And I mean that from a character standpoint. But this, the way it plays out here actually feels earned and actually feels well done. And compelling. Like, these are two characters that I would like to read more about and read more about the development of their relationship.
It restores a piece of Green Arrow that, for whatever reason, has been missing from a lot of Green Arrow stuff of late. Like, when they rebooted Green Arrow in the New 52, they tried to play up that he was this young, rich guy. Mm-hmm. And the TV series Arrow, you know, plays up that he's young and rich and he was a playboy and all this stuff. But it takes away the sort of political bent of Green Arrow, which I always thought was kind of one of the more interesting things about Green Arrow, you know, where he's this moneyed liberal. And this restores it without, like, hitting you over the head with it. it's not just like, hey, we got rid of all that other Green Arrow stuff. This is what Green Arrow is like now.
Yeah, and the thing is, I feel like if this book was just Green Arrow going, yeah, I'm a social justice warrior, like it would have fallen flatter than having Black Canary show up 2 pages later and be like, yeah, you know, you're still kind of a dick, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, you're on the right side of things, but you're still kind of a jackass.
And so I like that aspect of their relationship where they can kind of butt heads, you know, like yeah, they're not angry at each other, but they can disagree and debate. And I like that. I like that aspect of it.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to Superman Rebirth number one. And you talked about Green Arrow being a little rote. I feel like if any of these Rebirth issues had problems as far as the story that they tried to tell, this was the one that had the most problems for me.
Yeah, how did we get to this point? This is so complicated. Like, for this to be the start of a new era of Superman, this is so complicated. And I say that as someone who, like, I've maybe been a little dismissive of Peter Tomasi in the past. Because he's always felt to me like a... We talk about standard lengths of things, right? Like, yeah. Like Randy Orton is a standard length of wrestler, and the Toyota Corolla is a standard length of car. And Peter Tomasi, for me, has always been kind of like, yep, that is a comic book. It is one, parentheses, one comic book.
Yeah.
But his stuff on Superman, I think, has been really... really good, and I think Final Days of Superman was really solid and fun with the way that it played with so much weird Superman stuff from the past. But I think there's a level of Superman stuff from the past that you can tweak and make something fun with, and then there's a level of stuff from Superman's past that is super, that is John Byrne, Dan Jurgens Superman with a beard standing in New 52 Superman's tomb explaining the Kryptonian gestation matrix to New 52 Lana Lang. That is the point where I'm like, what are we doing here? Like, what is happening?
Well, here's my question about this issue. But before I get to that question, you mentioned Peter Tomasi. The art in this book is by Doug Monkey, who does a really good job with a book that's mostly just Superman and Lana Lang standing around. And that's what gets me. My question is, why is this the story that we wanted to tell, or that the DC Comics wanted to tell? Because I'd much rather see Superman, you know, old Dan Jurgens Superman and Lana Lang go on an adventure together than Superman standing around and telling her about the gestation matrix in front of a tomb with a Superman logo on it, and then revisiting Doomsday for the 1,000th time.
There wasn't a caption box that said, as seen in the Death and the Return of Superman, available in paperback from DC Comics in this issue, is shocking.
Yeah. And then going to the Fortress of Solitude, and then just being like, oh, it's not here, we can't bring him back. Oh, well. Like, that's the end of the story.
Yeah, it's a weirdly told story, and it's a weirdly paced story, and it's a story that is based on weird stuff. Like, of all the inexplicable decisions that DC has made, I think the weirdest and the most inexplicable is arguable. Like, I can kind of find rationale for everything except Dan Jurgens Superman surviving Convergence and then having lived in the New 52 universe for 5 years with a beard and a kid and Lois and Dan Jurgens, you know, John Byrne Lois.
It's the biggest leap that you have to make for a character change to have not, like, at least reversed some things in the New 52. Like, New 52 Superman needed so much fixing that they had to just bring in an old Superman and replace him with him, which is not what they've had to do for anybody else, right? And it's made it so complicated. And again, like, I would much rather just this be like New Superman and Lana Lang and New 52 Lana Lang, I don't know, investigating something together.
Yeah, like, the thing is, I don't think New 52 Superman needed fixing. He needed a new costume. He needed to not wear the terrible armor costume anymore. And he needed to you know, have more Lois in the book.
Well,
but
I mean,
that's all stuff you can do without bringing in, like, without just bringing in the one lasting effect of convergence.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the what they wanted, though, was Superman married to Lois again. And you couldn't really get New 52 Superman there. Easily. I don't know. But what I'm saying is, I just, like, just have Superman mention, like, hey, I went to the other Superman's Fortress of Solitude, tried to find this thing to bring him back, and I couldn't find it. And have that just be one dialogue bubble in the middle of this story where they're doing something instead of just standing around. It was a weird issue.
I feel like this issue and the way that it approaches Superman, and maybe the way, like, honestly, I think we're going to get an entirely new Superman in 6 months. I think we're going to find out that New 52 Superman wasn't Superman, and that Convergence Superman wasn't Superman. They were like two halves of the same whole. I don't know. Like, I think we're going to come out of this with a whole different thing. But I feel like this is an example of the bad way of looking backwards that DC does. Because DC Comics, as a company, knows that if you've read one DC comic, you've read Watchmen, right? That's a touchstone for people. That's why they keep going back to it. They know that if you've read two, you've read Watchmen and Dark Knight. Those are touchstones. That's why they keep going back to them. That's why, you know, Dark Knight kind of hangs over the Batman-Superman relationship for the past 30 years. If you've read three, you've read Watchmen, Dark Knight, and The Death of Superman. So they're going back and being like, what's the biggest pop cultural touchstone in comics for Superman? It's Death of Superman, the highest-selling graphic novel of the 90s. So going back and kind of saying, like, okay, this is where we're going back to start over. On that level makes sense, but it's such a weird choice from a storytelling standpoint. I don't think it works, which sucks because, like, I'm really interested in everything that's going on in the upcoming Superman books. I'm so excited for New Superman. I think, you know, Lex Luthor in a crazy armored suit being Superman is going to be good. But, you know, this is like if Marvel made a book because a lot of people bought X-Men number one in 1991. They made a whole new book for it. It's exactly like that, Matt. It's crazy. It would never work.
Yeah, what a wild idea. Before we move on, I don't think this precludes me from looking into what they're going to do with this Superman when the actual title launches. I just feel like this was a weird story to tell, and that's where I came down on it mostly. Before we wrap up, let's quickly talk about Green Lanterns number one, which focuses on Simon Boz and Jessica Cruz. It's by Jeff Johns and Sam Humphreys, co-writing, Ethan Van Sciver and Ed Bennis. Doing the art on that. You know, I like those two characters. I don't really know where the book is going, though. It's another one of these things that feels like prelude.
This is very much a zero issue. I've talked about this on the show before. Like, I've kind of resigned myself to being someone who's just never going to like Green Lantern. You know, I'm about to turn 34 in a few months, and it hasn't happened yet, and it's not going to happen, I don't think. But I do like Sam Humphreys, you know? So I wanted to give this a shot. And I'll say, the characters of Simon Boz and Jessica Cruz are really, really interesting. You know, Simon Boz, who is Green Lantern, but he's also kind of, I guess, informing on the Green Lantern Corps for the government to get out of other charges. Jessica Cruz, who was an agoraphobe and then had the fear ring and then got the Green Lantern ring. Like, I think they're inherently interesting in a way that I'm curious to see. And then Hal Jordan shows up and, like, tanks my interest. Like, as soon as you turn the page and Hal Jordan's like, I'm Hal Jordan, I'm the best Green Lantern. I'm like, oh no.
Well, when he shows up and he's like, okay, you two, we got to whip you into shape. You got to share this power battery, and you're doing a bad job, and da da da. And it's like, who are you to be Sarge all of a sudden, Hal Jordan? You fuck up all the time.
Yeah, he fucks up all the time. But, it's like, I really like the idea of an odd couple Green Lantern pairing, like, you know, the Defiant Ones with Green Lantern rings. Like, that's a thing that I haven't seen before. That's a thing that I wouldn't necessarily come up with. And that's a thing that I think would work really well with Simon Baz and Jessica Cruz in a way that I think is really exciting. Like, I am actually interested in picking up their book, even if, you know, whatever Hal Jordan's doing off in space with the Forgotten Guardian or whatever it is, do not care. And I recognize that is just a function of me never caring about Green Lantern. It's not going to happen. I'm sorry. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who don't give a shit about Alfred, but I do. But yeah, I'm interested in seeing where those characters go. So overall, a solid week for Rebirth, I think.
One last thing about Green Lanterns before we close up. I hope that Johns and Humphreys got this out of their system, because how many times in this issue do they mention the increasing number of Green Lanterns that Earth has?
I kind of like that.
I mean, I think it's something that you kind of have to acknowledge, but I don't know if you want to like point to it as much as this book points to it. Where it almost becomes a distraction, where it's just like, yeah, we know we made a lot of Green Lanterns on Earth.
Okay, but here's the thing about that, though. And this is a thing that I think is maybe necessary to do when you're doing a sci-fi story with a lot of aliens. Like, you kind of have to give a reason for humans and for Earth to be different. Whoever wrote the opening sequence, I think, did a really cool job with this. It seems like a very Geoff Johns-y sort of thing, but, you know, I don't know. I like the idea that they're like, yeah, you know, Hal Jordan joined the Green Lantern Corps and he changed the way things were done. John Stewart joined the Green Lantern Corps and he changed the way things were done. You know, Guy Gardner was a Green Lantern and he, you know, there were changes because of these people and they're important. And I feel like that's like when you have a franchise where the inherent nature of the franchise is that there's, you know, 3,600 of them or 7,200 of them or however many you want, there's a lot of them. You have to struggle against the idea that they're interchangeable. That's why I never understood why people got mad when Hal Jordan got replaced. Because the first thing that happens in a Green Lantern comic with Hal Jordan in it is that he replaces the old guy. So to kind of point out, like, yeah, you know, like, the Guardians really want to go with these Earth people, because while there's other great Green Lanterns, the human Green Lanterns change shit. And I thought that was a really cool way to put it. And I did like, I think it was Simon Baz saying like, yeah, there's like 17 Green Lanterns. It's whatever.
And then it turns out that Atrocitus was the one saying all that stuff about Hal Jordan and John Stewart and Guy Gardner, which is weird. All right. That's it for our comic segment. Chris, let's get into some panel president lists in just a second. But before that, so we've got someone, a special guest here for a moment to tell us a little bit about Loot Crate.
Hey everybody, you may remember me. My name's Equamantharian616. You may know me from a little April 5th, 2016 review on iTunes about this dumb War Rocket Ajax podcast. And dumb Matt Wilson. I hate Matt Wilson. I hate him. Am I supposed to believe he does stand-up? No, I don't. And even if he did, people would be booing him. For sure. You know what I don't hate? Loot Crate. Loot Crate is a monthly subscription box. For less than $20 a month, you get 6 to 8 items that include licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique, one-of-a-kind items, and more. You know who's not unique? Matt Wilson. Who's ununique? That's a word. You have until June 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific Time, that's California time for all you dumb Matt Wilsons out there, to subscribe and receive that month's crate, and when the cutoff happens, that's it, it's over, it's done. If you didn't get your Loot Crate box, you know who I would blame? Matt Wilson. Ugh. I bet he doesn't wear deodorant. I bet he sits there in his own filth and records this podcast in his underwear. Make sure to head to lootcrate.com/warrocketajax and enter code warrocketajax to save $3 off on any new subscription. June's theme is dystopia. You know what's my dystopia? Spending the end of the world with smelly Matt Wilson in his underwear. The box features classics RoboCop, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and The Matrix, and new faves Bioshock Infinite and Fallout 4. We've got a figure, cool collectibles, and of course, a t-shirt in every box. You know who has dumb t-shirts? Matt Wilson. Anyway, subscribe to Loot Crate. Get your box. Save $3 off. Equamantharian 616 out!
President.
Thank you, special guest, for telling us about Loot Crate. Chris, it's time for our segment where we take listener lists of characters from comic books, and then we place those characters on a list from best to worst. Chris, are you ready to take some panel president lists?
I am ready.
All right. The first list that we have comes from Jordan Bloom. And the theme of this list is B-list mutants who should be A-list.
Oh, I'm already in. I'm already in.
The first one on Jordan's list is Madrox the Multiple Man.
Never was a fan. Never was a fan. I never really read X-Factor when I was younger. Until the kind of, I guess, post-House of M X-Factor Investigations era. So I didn't grow up with Madrox. Madrox. And I say this, you know, he might be showing up in a comic I'm writing pretty soon. But yeah, I never really had that affection for him. I think he's a cool idea, and I think it's an idea that's been used in really cool ways, but I'm not, like, super huge into him. What do you think, Matt?
I'm kind of the same way. I think the best Madrox stuff, Multiple Man stuff, was from that solo series that he had in, like, the late 90s. That wasn't even called Multiple Man. It was just called Madrox.
Yeah, it was a miniseries, right? I remember that being pretty good. Was that also a Peter David book?
It was a Peter David book, yeah. But you know, outside of that miniseries, like, Multiple Man never really did that much to stand out to me, partially because I feel like the gimmick of being able to clone yourself, like, by the time I got around to knowing who Multiple Man was, I had seen that a lot, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not something that I was like, oh, what a cool power. Because it's not all that uncommon in not just superhero stories, but all kinds of stories. And for better or worse, there's not a whole lot to Multiple Man for me besides the power.
You know, this is something that I think comes up in that Madrox miniseries first, and it's definitely an X factor. The idea that he, you know, sent a bunch of dupes out into the world to learn stuff, and they came back, that's a really, really cool idea. But it was done better in Dr. McNinja. Like, Chris Hastings did that better with Dr. McNinja's clones.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I feel like for better or worse, Multiple Man feels like the B version of that character type.
Yeah. And, I do feel like if we had, if one of us had sat down and read, like, 100 issues of X-Factor, you know, if we had Jay and Miles on here, we'd probably get some argument and some pushback on that. But for me, yeah, it's, he's fine, but okay. he's not my fave.
The definition of just, like, baseline fine is Fletcher Aerosmith. So do we think he's okay above that? Because what we've got above that is Donna Troy, the original Human Torch, Carly Cooper, Adam X.
I can tell you for sure that he's not as good as Adam X.
Okay, that's our ceiling.
I don't think he's as bad as Donna Troy, but I wouldn't rather read a Donna Troy story than a Jimmy Madrox story.
I think
that was a lie I told you a second ago.
I think he should probably go right under Adam X.
So you would put him above Carly Cooper?
Yeah.
Okay, then that is where he shall go. And the Multiple Man, Jamie Madrox, enters the list at number 55.
All right, the next one on Jordan's list, someone alert L. Collins, one of L's favorite characters, Boom Boom.
Tabitha.
That's right.
Here's the thing, and I think that you're going to be the same way. Is your point of reference for Boom Boom Next Wave?
Mostly, yeah. And I know L hates the version of Boom Boom from Next Wave. L thinks that Next Wave gets her wrong.
I don't doubt it. But yeah, Boom Boom and Next Wave is, like, my almost entire point of reference for her, And I love Boom Boom in Next Wave.
Me too.
I love everybody in Next Wave.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for us to rank those characters against each other. But can we rank solely on the basis of Next Wave? Because, I mean, Next Wave Machine Man isn't really what Machine Man is like either.
No, it's not. But I feel like, okay, Machine Man being a weird Jack Kirby creation who's been around for 40 years, like, as soon as Next Wave happened, the next time you saw that guy, he was Next Wave Machine Man. You know? Like, that stuck for him.
For a while. For a little while. Not permanently, but yeah.
I think it supplanted, or at least added to, everything that had gone on before, you know? Whereas, say, Earth X did not.
Fair. That's totally fair.
Getting back to Boom Boom, yeah, like, I don't have... I am not the New Mutants fan. People are going to be so mad at me right now, because I'm writing an X-Men book, and I'm like, yeah, I never read New Mutants, never really read X-Factor. Mostly just in New Mutants for Cable. But yeah, like, sorry, everybody. Don't get a lot of love for Cannonball.
I do think that there are some shared traits between, you know, previous Boom Boom and Next Wave Boom Boom, in that she had a real, like, taste for making things explode, hence her name.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's another thing that I think is important for my point of reference. I got largely into X-Men, not necessarily through comics, but because, you know, the cartoon led me to buy a ton of trading cards. So I had trading cards of Boom Boom. So I had the trading card description, and she just sounded like Jubilee. So I love Jubilee. So I'm never gonna like as much the character that in my head, whether or not it's a valid interpretation, I mean, I was 10, but in my head, when I was a kid, she was the second-rate Jubilee. You know, which I don't know if the chronology of comics bears that out, nor do I know if the content of the comics bears it out, but that's always what she was in my head. So that might be why the Next Wave version is so prominent for me.
All right. Bearing all that in mind, where will we rank Boom Boom?
I mean, I'm looking at other mutants we have on the list, right?
Well, Husk is pretty high.
Husk is really high. I certainly have more affection for M, but I'm also writing a book where M is playing a not a huge part, but she's a speaking member of the cast. So
yeah,
I would not put Boom Boom as high as M, but I could probably be talked into it just because I realize that is a, like, yeah, I have written scenes with M. I really like writing those scenes. So
I don't know if I'd put her above Chamber myself. But I don't think she goes that far below either Chamber or M. If you don't want to put her above M, I would say she goes right below.
I am fine with that. I'm fine with her entering the list at number 43 between M and Casanova Quinn.
Please don't be mad at us, L. We did our best.
We are but the voices.
The next one on Jordan's list is Danny Moonstar.
Again, I never was a New Mutants guy. I have zero point of reference. Like, I have listened to Jay and Miles explain the X-Men, and that is the most exposure I've had to Danny Moonstar.
Yeah, I have basically nothing myself. Also known as Mirage. But yeah, I have almost nothing for Danny Moonstar, which is too bad. Because Mirage is one of the more prominent Native American superhero characters.
Yeah.
So maybe I should get into trying to read more Danny Moonstar stories. But so are we going to have to disqualify?
I think we have to disqualify due to a lack of familiarity. And I am really feeling the shame of that in this list.
Well, what about Wolfsbane, who is next on the list?
Same boat. A little more familiar with Wolfsbane. Again, she may or may not be in a comic that I'm co-writing coming up. Okay. But, you know, look, that's why I got Chad, guys. Chad loves New Mutants. Skip talk to Chad.
All right, this last one on Jordan's list we can do, though. That is Dazzler.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I have not necessarily complicated feelings about Dazzler, but I have a lot of frustrations about Dazzler because she always seems to be lagging just enough behind the times, you know? Like, I love the original, like, roller skating Disco Dazzler, but, like, that is a character who comes about, like, in the late 70s. Well past the sell-by date on Disco.
Right.
And so I feel like, you know, even when she changes and she gets, like, you know, she in the 90s she had a costume that kind of looked like it was from the 80s. In the 2000s she had a costume that kind of looked like it was from the 90s. And I feel like that might be part of her charm. But I also feel like that is a thing that holds her back. You gotta be young. You gotta be young to make a Dazzler story. I think should be the rule.
Well, here's the problem with Dazzler, and I like Dazzler. Well, two problems. One is that she often feels like she was created by, which she actually was created by committee. And then anytime there is a change to her character, that change is decided by committee. That's why it always feels like she's a little bit behind. That's why in 2014, Dazzler wasn't suddenly like a trap artist, right? Like, that's like she should be on whatever the newest trend is.
Yeah, like, and Dazzler she's always has to just, be on the next thing.
She's got to be on the next thing, and she never is. And then the other thing is, I feel like Dazzler is always or almost always presented as a novelty instead of as a character. That's not always true.
Yeah.
Dazzler has been characterized very well before and presented, you know, in an honest, meaningful way. But sometimes she's just trotted out there as like, haha, Dazzler.
Because she is. She's a novelty character who was good enough and kind of fun enough to stick around. And that puts her in a really weird place as a character. But I like that about her. I like that she occupies a role in the Marvel Universe that by all rights she should not. You know? Like, well, she turned down the X-Men.
Yeah, we've talked about novelty characters on this list before and ranked them with affection, namely Stiltman.
It's not a novelty, bro. It's for life.
Stiltman for life. I'm not knocking her for being a novelty character. Novelty characters can be super fun, and I think she often is. I just think there's a lot more potential to Dazzler than is often realized.
I like Dazzler, and I think Dazzler is one of those characters where everybody's got a plan to do it. You know, Dazzler is, weirdly enough, in the way that everybody has a Batman pitch, I feel like everybody's got a Dazzler pitch. And that's a cool thing about her. Like, because the core idea of, you know, the celebrity mutant is a good idea. It's a really good idea. And like, regardless of the trappings of the era, regardless of you know, if she's a disco queen or a aerobics, you know, 80s aerobics lady or a singer-songwriter, I think the idea of, like, hey, Dazzler, she's famous. You know, she's the gem of the Marvel Universe. I think that's there's so much meat on those bones. You know, that idea has some, like, legs.
I made a joke about Trap Dazzler, but
I would read in a heartbeat.
I've seen a lot of people pitch the idea of a DJ Dazzler, which seems like exactly what she should be now.
Well, except that that's like a, like, that's a very, like, 2010 idea now.
Yeah, that's fair. I feel like that still has some legs in 2016, but it probably won't last too far beyond it. So, yeah. All right, but let's rank her. Again, Husk is a pretty important place in our list.
I think Dazzler almost, like, I would join the riot that's going to happen if we rank Husk above Dazzler.
Okay.
I think
that's good and fine. what we have above Husk is Ultimate Spider-Man, Steel, Barry Allen, Hobbs, Miss Misery, Michelangelo.
See, here we're running into the same problem that we run into with the Every Story Ever list, is that I feel like she's not as good as Steel, but she's probably better than Barry Allen. But we ranked Barry Allen above Steel, so
I think she can probably go between Steel and Ultimate Peter Parker.
I think that's a good place to put her.
Okay.
So Allison Blair, Dazzler, enters the list at number 31.
Jordan, thank you for sending in that list. Yeah, sorry that we could not get to everything. All right, this list comes from Chris. That's your name.
That's my name.
And he just has three for us, okay?
Okay.
The first one is Marvel Hercules.
Love that guy.
Love that guy.
Oh, he is here to give us the gift of battle, Matt. Okay, Hercules, for being a second-rate Thor, because he is great.
Well, okay, so we talked about Multiple Man being sort of a second-rate version of a character who can make duplicates of themselves.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about Hercules, though, being a kind of a second-rate Thor, or the B-list, one of many B-list Thors, it feels like you can do things with Hercules that you can't do with Thor. Like, imagine... Yeah. You couldn't have a book, a series, a long running series about Thor where he teams up with one of the world's smartest teens and goes on romance adventures.
Yes. But like that, I don't think would have worked.
But Hercules did.
For Hercules, yeah. You know, as good a character as Thor is, and I think, you know, he's not on the list yet, but I feel like Thor is going to probably rank pretty highly. Hercules can do different stuff, largely because Thor already fills that role. Like, Thor is the big mythological hero that you want in your universe. So Hercules is free to, like, kind of fuck around, you know? Like, he can be a champion. He can be an Avenger in kind of a, like, you know, in a time when Thor wasn't around. Like, he you know, he's in the Avengers in Under Siege. Which, it's hard to imagine Under Siege happening if Thor was around. You know, Hercules, get him drunk and hit him with a truck, and he's out of the way. That adaptability is a really key part of Hercules, but he's also just been in really, really good stories.
I mean, the Incredible Hercules, that series is going to raise him many spots on the list.
Yeah, alone. I mean, it's, like, that is his definitive run. And... like, I always say that the best time to read comics is now, because you have everything that came before. But, you know, since I wasn't really around to read Walt Simonson's Thor at the time that it was coming out, I am so glad that I was around to read Incredible Hercules when it was coming out, having already read Thor. You know, like, and seeing the contrast and the way that it used the similar approach and deviated and weaved all the mythology stuff in with superhero stuff. Like, there will, in the way that, like, every Thor run has to kind of contend with Simonson, I think every Hercules book is always going to be in the shadow of what Greg Pak and Fred Van Lente and Riley Brown and Clayton Henry did on that book.
There's so much you can do with the Marvel version of Hercules. Like, Thor has to... you can change Thor to a degree. You can give him chainmail sleeves. You can replace him with Thunderstrike for a while. But really, Thor's got to be Thor in general.
Mm-hmm.
Hercules can kind of have an ebb and flow to him. You know, this has been controversial, but, like, the whole, you know, whether he's bisexual or not thing, like... that's something that has ebbed and flowed with him. Whether he's a serious character or a comedy character is something that has ebbed and flowed with him. And he is not upfront enough that those things can change. And, I mean, obviously people will notice because there's been notice taken of changes made to his character lately, but you're freer to do things with Hercules than you are with Thor. And you know, Hercules is a depowered, is less powered than Thor because he's part human. He's half human. So you got that element that you can use as well. There's just so much flexibility that you can use with Hercules, the mythological character, and Marvel's version in particular.
Now, do you think it hurts Hercules that we have kind of only been talking about him in contrast to Thor? Like, that he, like, does it hurt him that he's never going to be out of that shadow?
I mean, it means he's not ever going to surpass Thor on the list. Like, Thor is obviously the more important character.
That is true.
But, you know, that's just how it ended up. Like, Stanley and Jack Kirby did a Thor comic before they did a Hercules comic.
That is true. Looking at other Marvel versions of public domain characters on the list,
we have Dracula, pretty high.
We have Dracula. Dracula is ranking pretty high on this list. Do you think Hercules belongs above Dracula?
No. But I do think he's weirdly comparable, to use that phrase, to Plastic Man.
That's interesting.
Because I know Plastic Man's a Golden Age character. But in the modern era, I feel like Plastic Man is sort of the, you know, the Marvel Hercules compared to Thor. You've got Plastic Man compared to, like, Elongated Man or Mr. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Hercules kind of plays that same role that Plastic Man does, of, like, you can go crazy with him and people won't mind as much. Now, weirdly enough, we have Plastic Man above Mr. Fantastic. That said, I don't think he goes right under Plastic Man, Hercules, or right above. I don't think he goes above Mr. Fantastic. I don't really think he goes above Deadpool. But looking a little further down, you know, I could see an argument for him being above or just below Black Cat.
I don't think he's as good as Emma Frost. And I think part of that is because Emma Frost has still not quite had that definitive run. So I see a lot of potential in her.
Mm-hmm.
She's had really good runs as part of a team, but she's never had that kind of definitive solo run like her kids had.
And I think that could definitely happen for Emma Frost. No doubt.
Oh, I think that could easily happen. I think we're not far from it happening. So I would put him below Emma Frost, but above Blue Beetle.
Okay, I think that's good. I think that's fair.
All right, so entering the list, number 24, Hercules.
Number 2 on Chris's list is Robo from Atomic Robo.
Like that guy.
It's weird that he mistyped Hellboy, but...
Yeah, I was going to ask. Like, it's a shame that Mike Mignola's not doing any of those stories anymore. No, we kid. Robo's really good. You know, we've talked about that scene in that first Atomic Robo story before, where he goes, "Hey, I'm 83 years old." And he has that moment where he kind of talks about the tragedy of his existence, but then that's not really a central part of his character. Like, it's there, but it's not the thing. And I think that makes his character work in a really, really interesting way.
Yeah, and we've talked about the storytelling potential of these characters a lot. And Robo has it in spades because he has a century almost of history of stories that you can tell about him. And you can even go into the future and tell stories about him. And there's going to be a certain consistency of character to him throughout that time. I mean, one of the cool things about Atomic Robo is that he becomes more experienced and seasoned over time, but he's a robot. So there's a certain consistency to his character no matter when the story is set that you don't get with, you know, a character who's a human being who is going to age.
I mean, I'll go ahead and say it, like, the jumping around in time and the way that that affects Robo as a character is done better in Atomic Robo than it is in Tom Strong.
It's like, really clever in Atomic Robo.
Really well done. Robo's great, and Robo's the kind of character that, again, he's one of those guys that you could do any kind of story with. And I think Clevenger and Wegner have kind of proven that with what they've done. You know, like let's do a weird time travel story. Let's do a kind of supernatural-y story. Let's do the fly-in She-Devils of the Pacific. Like, there's... The world is adaptable enough, and the character is adaptable enough, that it all really works well. So, I like Robo a lot.
Okay, so we have Dr. Dinosaur from Atomic Robo on the list already as well. Mm-hmm. Are we bound to put Robo above Dr. Dinosaur? Do you think he should go above Dr. Dinosaur?
I think he should. Dr. Dinosaur is fun, but Dr. Dinosaur is only fun because he fights Atomic Robo. You know? Like, he is one that would absolutely not exist.
So above him, we have several touch points that we've already discussed. Blue Beetle, Emma Frost, Black Cat, Jack Knight, Starman, Kingpin, and Marvel Hercules, who we just talked about, is in there as well.
I would say definitively, in my head, I don't know if he's better than Jack Knight, but I would put him above all of those other characters.
All right, I think then Robo is going to go between Jack Knight and Black Cat. The third character on Chris's list is Wilson Fisk, the Kingpin, who we have already ranked.
Yep, he is currently sitting at number 20 on the list.
So, Chris, thank you for sending in that list. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun.
Up next, we have this list from Alexandria Seal. And this is just a list of her faves, all right? These are just characters she likes.
Okay, I'm ready.
Now, some of these are characters that I have expressed an affinity for as well.
Oh, okay.
So get ready for that. And some of these are characters that you like a lot as well, Chris. So we'll see where we end up. The first one is Big Barda.
Oh. Yeah, I love Big Barda.
Big Barda is amazing.
I think the question is... Is Big Barda better than Darkseid? And that's one I could go either way on, to be honest.
I think the answer has to be no, though. I don't think she is.
Like, sheer volume of stories would tip things in favor of Darkseid. But, like, there's a lot of really good Barda stories.
There's also a lot of really bad Barda stories.
There's some bad ones. There's some regrettable ones.
Maybe regrettable is what I mean instead of bad.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like outside of Kirby and a few other writers that know how to treat her, a lot of people don't know what to do with her.
The Barda's arc is that she's, you know, the most ferocious fighter on the planet Apocalypse. Like, she is the toughest person on the planet where murder is a household word. But all she wants, like, I feel like it's one of the very rare cases in comics where having a woman who is a prominent character who ends up being like, yeah, I really just want to get married. Like, I really just want to marry this guy I'm in love with and go be a suburban housewife. Under less talented creators, certainly, but with a character who wasn't developed as well as Barda and with a character whose relationships weren't as developed as Barda and Scott, you know, my favorite romantic relationship in comics, like, that would be, like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing with this, you know, with this great female character? By kind of reducing her to that. But it comes off as genuine with Barda. And part of the reason that it comes off as genuine is because you see them go through so much. And, like, Barda will still, like, suit up and throw down. Like, she'll still show up and join the Justice League. It's just, you know, that's just her day job. Like, what she really wants to do is have a nice house in the suburbs with her escape artist husband.
That trope comes up for male heroes all the time also, where it's just like, I just want to go home to my wife, right?
Yeah.
And so I you know, why shouldn't Barda get that too?
Yeah.
You know, why shouldn't she want to just like go home and be happy instead of having to do all this fighting that only she can do because she's so good at it?
And I feel like one of the biggest problems with Barda is that she's, you know, there's never been a book called Big Barda. That the focus is almost always on Scott, I think, is not necessarily a bad thing, because Scott's a great character, but I feel like in an ideal world where I was in charge of DC Comics and sales did not matter, like, there would be a Big Barda book and a Mr. Miracle book, and they would be like, you know, they would be like one biweekly Barda and Scott book, but you would see, you know, Scott doing his Mr. Miracle stuff, and you'd see Barda being a superhero, because I think she's the one who's more suited to be a superhero.
She certainly fits the archetype a little more cleanly than Mr. Miracle does. But where does Barda land?
If we're putting her below Darkseid, which I think is a good call, then I mean, like, I like her more than I like Mary Jane. I think she's probably tied for me with Ray Smuckles. She does not go. I do not think she goes lower than Mary Jane.
Yeah, I'm good with that. I think we can put her just under Darkseid.
All right, so Barda Free, Big Barda of the Female Furies, enters the list at number 12 between Darkseid and Ray Smuckles, aka Son of Rodney, a cat in a thong.
Next on Alexandria's list is Clarion the Witch Boy.
Oh, love that dude too.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, Clarion is not in the top tier of Jack Kirby characters. He's not as... A lot of people have affection for Clarion that I think is based on potential, in that he's like a cool character that can show up and do cool stuff, but I don't think he's ever had a moment where that potential is played up. Like, he's really just a, you know, he's a bad guy who shows up in The Demon, and he's more engaging and more entertaining than probably any other villain in that run. Like, he fits an archetype that comics didn't have at the time.
I think it's easy for a lot of readers to identify with Clarion in a weird way, because he's a weird kid from a weird place who just wants to expand his horizons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And wants to go out and learn some stuff and do something fun and cool with his cat. Because otherwise he's just cooped up in his, like, witch world dimension.
Yeah, but I mean, also, that's one interpretation of Clarion. that's the modern kind of protagonist interpretation of Clarion, but that's a relatively new invention. I mean, I think it works. And I think that is largely, I don't know if that's necessarily because of the character or because of the potential of the archetype, which are, you know, I mean, that's splitting hairs, you know. But Clarion as written as a Kirby character doesn't have that element in the way that Clarion of the modern era does, which I think is cool. Like, I think it's cool that you can take that and develop it. Because, listen, the name Clarion the Witch Boy is amazing. It's a great name. And he's such a weird design. He's got devil horns in his hair.
He sure does. Okay. Do we think... I think we're going to scroll down on the list for Clarion a good amount. Do we think that Clarion is better than, say, like a Prometheus? Better than, say... than, I mean, we've got Namor pretty... actually kind of far down here.
I mean, I think Clarion is... Here's the thing. I like Clarion, and I don't really like Namor.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I mean, do you think Clarion is better than, like, a Megatron? Do you think he's better than,
What weird sentences that we have been asked to say.
Sure. Well, okay, the next Kirby character we have is Annihilus.
I think, honestly, I think Clarion is on par with Annihilus. Because while I think Clarion has more potential, Annihilus has had cooler stories. Annihilus has had much cooler moments than Clarion.
I would definitely put Clarion below Annihilus.
So, okay, so would you say, now you're a Transmet guy, would you say Clarion's better than Spider Jerusalem or worse?
Worse, I think that Clarion actually goes below a lot of these characters, below that. I think I'd maybe put him between below Harley Quinn, though, above Prometheus.
Yeah, I think that's a good place for him. I think that is a... I fully agree with that.
Okay. Next on Alexandria's list is going to be a divisive one.
Okay.
Raphael the Ninja Turtle from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Now, we've already determined that we're going to rank the four Ninja Turtles together.
Mm-hmm.
We've already ranked Michelangelo,
mm-hmm.
who is your favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Raphael is my favorite.
Uh-huh.
Are we at stalemate? How are we going to decide this?
Well, I don't know, Matt. I mean, did you write like a 1,600-word article explaining why Raphael should be the best one? Because I wrote one for Michelangelo. Seems like you're slacking off.
Look, that's your job. That's not my job.
Yeah, like, this is... Okay, convince me.
Here's the reason I say Raphael is the best of the turtles. And it's something we brought up when we were talking about Michelangelo. By virtue of the fact that he's the loner of the team,
mm-hmm.
that he is the one who will, like, go off on his own and clear his head and wear a trench coat and wear, like, a weird black costume over that, like, covers his whole body and all of that kind of stuff. Raphael, to me, feels like the only one who really works well in solo stories.
Mm-hmm.
And thus, that to me, that makes him the strongest and best character. I would read a solo Raphael series. I don't know if I would read a solo series about any of the other three.
Matt, I'm going to flip this around because I got you. You're nailed, son. You have previously told me, not as part of the list, but you've previously told me that you think Wolverine only really works when he has something to push back against. So you prefer Wolverine as part of a team than as a solo character, correct or incorrect, true or false?
That's true. That is true.
So you're applying the same thing to Raphael and saying that you prefer Raphael because of it.
I like Raphael more than Wolverine, and I think Wolverine doesn't fit in the same box as Raphael. Point taken. I think
Wolverine absolutely fits in the same box as Raphael.
I mean, there's some good Wolverine solo stories.
There's some very good Wolverine solo stories.
I think we're just going to have to, like, roll a die or something.
All right. I have an 8-sided die right here. Do you want to call odds or evens?
All right, I'll call evens. I can't believe this is the way we're deciding this, but it's the only way it's going to happen.
Yeah, like, look, because I'm not giving up on this one. I'm not. I will abide by the die roll. And it's funny that I'm the one making it, and you can't see me right now.
Yeah, I'm putting all my trust in you.
All right, actually, I'm not going to use this. I'm not going to use this 8-sided die because it's too hard to see. I've got a 6-sided die here. Here we go. You're taking evens, you said?
I'm taking evens, yeah.
You're taking evens? Okay, I'll take odds. This will determine who the superior Ninja Turtle is. All right, it is 4, so you got it. You got it.
Oh, Raphael goes on top.
Unbelievable. But fate has decreed. We are merely the mouthpieces. We are merely the arbiters.
This is going to be our standard tiebreaker from now on. The die.
Yeah, because that's what people want. Like, hey, everybody, patreon.com/warrockandajax. Listen to Chris and Matt roll dice and say character names. Because I will very much give up on these debates if it's that simple.
The next one on Alexandria's list is Roast Beef Katsanzakis, co-lead of Akewood. This is another one we discussed when we ranked Ray Smuckles. I said I'm a big roast beef fan.
Unsurprising.
But I honestly don't know if he should go above Ray on the list.
Roast beef is, and I think this is going to be a controversial statement, Roast Beef is not as complicated a character as Rey. He is driven by, like, one thing in all situations. And Rey is arguably a, like, an easy-to-understand guy. But he is, you know, he acts a different way around all the other characters in Akewood. Beef is a constant. Roast Beef acts the same way in every situation. Rey acts differently around Beef than he does around Pat. And he acts differently around them than he does around Theodore, around his dad, around Todd, around... like, Rey is a more complex character than Beef. I will stand by that.
I think they're complex in different ways, the two of them. Beef is complex because there's so much realness to him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so much to identify with in him if you are a person who, you know, experiences the same kind of anxiety and, you know, like the recent Akewood where they show up and give him an empty book that he has to fill in himself.
Mm-hmm.
and his reaction to it, where it's just like, it's hard for you to accept anything. Like, Roast Beef is a character who finds it hard to accept anything. But if he gets put in the right situation, he's a very resourceful and useful character. Like, I feel like, but by virtue of Roast Beef being the quieter one, and that his the font for his dialogue is smaller
and unpunctuated.
Yes, I think you can kind of read more complexity into Roast Beef. Even though I think you're also right to say that he interacts with everybody, every other character, the same way that he would with anybody else.
I think the question of Rey and Beef is, do you prefer the reality that you can relate to? Or do you prefer the heightened reality that of essentially the magical realism of Akewood? Because what, you know, what's Rey's defining story? It's the great outdoor fight. And what's Beef's defining story is the wedding. You know, it is a much more relatable story to get married, even with all the weirdness that happens in that story, than it is to beat up 3,000 men.
By the same token, the great outdoor fight wouldn't have ended the way it did without Beef.
No, I mean, Beef's great in Great Outdoor Fight, but I don't think, like, if that's anyone's defining story, it's Rey's.
Sure.
And it's because the onus is on Rey in that story to define friendship, to define his relationship with his father, to define his relationship with Beef, to define his relationship with history and with the future. Whereas the wedding is the defining story for Beef because the onus is on him to do one good thing with his miserable fucking life.
That's all fair. I think I can agree to put Beef below Rey, but how much further below?
Right under Rey, we have Mary Jane Watson.
Yeah.
Who's a weird comparison with Roast Beef Kazantzakis.
You know who's not a weird comparison with Roast Beef, though? Charlie Brown.
Oh, okay. Yeah, now we're getting somewhere.
I sort of tried to be a little contrarian when we talked about Charlie Brown earlier. I do feel like there is no Roast Beef without Charlie Brown.
Absolutely not.
So I think we probably have to put him at least just below Charlie Brown.
Well, that would mean that would put him above Marvel Dracula.
Sure.
Are you okay with that? Like, do I have to compare Dracula to Roast Beef right now? I do. Okay. Absolute floor, I think, is Plastic Man. I think we can agree that he's better than Plastic Man.
Yeah. He's either going right above or right below Dracula. If you insist, I will be fine with putting him right below Dracula.
We got mad odds or evens.
I'll take odds this time.
Evens it is. It was a 6, so he goes below Dracula.
Okay.
Above Eel O'Brien, Plastic Man.
All right, the last one here on Alexandria's list. Get ready to freak out, Chris. One, Mr. Laird James McCullen Destro, the 24th.
Yes! Yes! Yes, the best. The best. It's weird how two characters in the top 20 were created by Chris Onstad, but it's even weirder that the fourth greatest character of all time is not Superman, it's Destro.
I think I might have to talk you down from that. I don't think we can put him above Superman on the real.
Okay, but like, I think I've explained why I love Destro so much before, right?
Yes.
Because, okay, very basic level, he looks cool as shit. His head is made of metal. He's got his chest on display. He has a massive medallion. He has rockets on his wrist. He's great. But, like, on a deeper level, Destro is, and I mean this legitimately, Destro is the best example of the honorable villain archetype. Because he's a villain. He's a, you know, bare mins, he is an arms dealer. And, you know, he's also an arms dealer who works with terrorists. But he's a guy who's kind of, you know, he doesn't have, like, he's kind of with Cobra Commander now, and he doesn't like him, and he doesn't agree with him, and he doesn't even, you know, he doesn't even hate the Joes, but, you know, this is the guy who's buying the laser guns, so I guess, and my girlfriend works for him, so I guess I'm stuck with this guy, and I find that very relatable, because we've all had the job where you're like, guess I'm working for this guy.
And it adds a dynamic to Cobra where it's not all just, you know, just everybody falls in line and you know, lines up behind Cobra Commander. Destro fills the role of being the guy who's like, wait a minute, let's rethink this. You know?
The fact that Destro and Cobra Commander just, like, kind of hate each other, but the Baroness is loyal to Cobra Commander and is in love with Destro, but she's, like, frustrated with both of them all the time. It's one of the best relationships in comics. And I know I'm a G.I. Joe guy, but honest to God, the character work with those characters is phenomenal. But yeah, Destro's fucking great.
Isn't it weird how much higher all the bad guys are going to be, all the bad guys from G.I. Joe, all of Cobra is going to be than any of the Joes on this list?
Oh yeah, it's going to be Destro Baroness Cobra Commander, like, rounding out the top 10.
This is setting up another potential showdown later, another potential die roll later, but, like, I'm a huge Cobra Commander fan.
Here's what explains us, Matt, is the characters who are very close together that you prefer and that I prefer.
Yep.
That you're a Raphael and I'm a Michelangelo. That you're a roast beef and I'm a Race Muckles. That I'm a Destro and you're a Cobra Commander. Because in theory, you should be the Destro because you're the one who's stuck with me.
But I'm the Cobra Commander because I've got, you know, I got these big plans.
You do have the big plans.
I got these big plans. Okay. Realistically, I agree with everything you said about Destro, but I don't think he cracks our top six.
Okay, can I give you my absolute floor? Like, this is the basement floor. This is as low as I am willing to go, even in theory.
Okay,
Norman Osborn.
Yeah, that's fine. I think he probably can go above that. Where I start having a hard time is around Darkseid Lex Luthor.
Yeah, like, the thing is, I absolutely think Destro is better than Lex Luthor, but in, like, intellectually I feel like that's wrong. But I absolutely think it, and I want everybody to know I think it.
Would you want to put him above Darkseid?
I don't think Destro has any of the problems that we discussed with Darkseid, is the thing. Because he's just complex enough to be great, and just simple enough that you can beat him. Like, that he can, you know, shake his fist and retreat to the Silent Castle to plan another day. Like,
All right, then let's mark him in. Let's put him between Lex Luthor and Darkseid.
So entering the list at number 11 is Destro, Laird James McCullen Destro the 24th.
Alexandria, thank you so very much for that list. That is probably all the panel presidency, panel president electioneering that we can do this week. But if you would like to send us a panel president list, you can do so by emailing us at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That email address is also where you can send every story ever lists, where you can send listener questions. If you have a comment that you would like to send us, you can do so there. If you'd like to sponsor the show, you can let us know at that email address. You can also send listener questions to our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. Check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Also, check us out on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and you search for War Rocket Ajax, that is where you will find the show. If you like the show, leave us a review. The more positive reviews we get, the more we are featured on the show. I actually asked for some reviews on Twitter last week because iTunes changed its ranking format so that we were suddenly 4.5 stars. We're back up to 5, everybody. Thank you to everyone who went and reviewed us on iTunes to get us there. We do appreciate it greatly. Now we've reached a part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson, and you will find links to my Twitter, my Tumblr, and my books on Amazon. Also, you can find my comic that I create with Kevin Warren, Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective, on Comixology. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
Everybody can find links to my stuff at about.me/ChrisSims. You can also find the comics I have written and co-written on Comixology. Just search for my name, Chris Sims. And hey, we didn't mention it in the comics review section, but X-Men 92 number 4 came out this week. That wraps up the first story arc, the Vampires versus the X-Men arc that I've been wanting to do forever, is now over. I hope everybody enjoyed it. If you haven't read it yet, go pick it up. And if you want a complete story, 1, 2, 3, and 4 should either be available at your local comic shop, or you can find them on comixology.com. Everything else, I'm on Twitter and Tumblr at the ISB. That's TheIsb. I think that's about it, right? Did I put over my comics? Okay, here we go. This has been War Rocket Ajax number 307. We're going to be back next week with a very exciting interview. Someone who hasn't been on the show since the very, very early days is coming back. So if you're a longtime fan, it's going to be very exciting to catch up with this person about a new project that they have in the works. So be here for that next week. And until then, have a nice time and drink a shrub.
Yeah!
Buy my yard sale shit.